Chapter 2. Sunday's Surprise Arrests. Palo Alto's population is closing in on 60,000 citizens, but its main distinction derives from the 11,000 students living and studying about a mile away down Palm Drive, with its hundreds of palm trees lining the entrance to Stanford University. Stanford is like a sprawling mini-city covering more than 8,000 acres with its own police and fire departments and post office. Just an hour's drive north is San Francisco. Palo Alto, by contrast, is safer, cleaner, quieter, and whiter. Most blacks live across the Highway 101 tracks at the east end of town, in East Palo Alto. In comparison to the rundown multi-story tenement buildings I was used to, East Palo Alto's single and two-family houses more nearly resemble a suburb where my high school teacher might have dreamed of living if he could have saved enough money by moonlighting as a cab driver. Yet all around this oasis, trouble has begun brewing of late. Over in Oakland, the Black Panther Party is promoting black pride, backed by black power, to resist racist practices by all means necessary. Prisons are becoming centers for recruiting a new breed of political prisoners, inspired by George Jackson, who was about to go on trial with his Soledad brothers for the alleged murder of a prison guard. The women's liberation movement is picking up steam, dedicated to ending women's secondary citizenship and fostering new opportunities for them. The unpopular war in Vietnam drags on as body counts soar daily. That tragedy worsens as the Nixon-Kissinger administration reacts to anti-war activists with ever greater bombings in reaction to the mass demonstrations against the war. The military-industrial complex is the enemy of this new generation of people who openly question its aggressive commercial exploitation values. For anyone who likes to live in a truly dynamic era, this zeitgeist is unlike any in recent history. Communal evil, communal good. Intrigued by the contrasts between the sense of ambient anonymity I lived with in New York City and this sense of community and personal identity that I felt in Palo Alto, I decided to conduct a simple field experiment to test the validity of this difference. I had become interested in the antisocial effects that anonymity induced when people felt no one could identify with them when they were in a setting that encouraged aggression. Based on the Lord of the Flies conception of masks liberating hostile impulses, I had conducted research showing that research participants who were de-individuated more readily inflicted pain on others than did those who felt more individuated. Now I wanted to see what the good citizens of Palo Alto would do in response to the temptation offered by an invitation to vandalism. I designed a candid camera-type field study that involved abandoning automobiles in Palo Alto and, as a comparison, 3,000 miles away in the Bronx. Good-looking cars were placed across the street from the campuses of New York University's Bronx campus and Stanford University, with their hoods raised and license plates removed, sure releaser signals to lure citizens into becoming vandals. From concealed vantage points, my research team watched and photographed the action in the Bronx and videotaped the Palo Alto scene. We had not yet set up our recording equipment in the Bronx when the first vandals appeared and began stripping the car, Dad barking orders for Mom to empty the trunk and the son to check out the glove compartment while he removed the battery. Passers-by, walking and driving, stopped to strip our helpless car of any and all items of value before the demolition derby began. This episode was followed by a parade of vandals who systematically stripped and then demolished that vulnerable New York City car. Time magazine carried this sad tale of urban anonymity at work under the heading Diary of an Abandoned Automobile. In a matter of days, we recorded 23 separate destructive incidents on that hapless Oldsmobile in the Bronx. The vandals turned out to be just ordinary citizens. They were all white, well-dressed adults who, under other circumstances, might demand more police protection and less coddling of criminals, and would very definitely agree with the opinion poll item about the necessity for more law and order. Contrary to expectation, only one of these acts was performed by kids simply delighting in the joys of destruction. Even more surprising, all this destruction took place in broad daylight, so we had no need for our infrared film. Internalized anonymity needs no darkness for its expression. But what was the fate of our abandoned Palo Alto car, which had also been made to look obviously vulnerable to assault? After a full week, there was not a single act of vandalism against it. People passed by, drove by, looked at it, but no one even touched it. Well, not exactly. It rained one day, and a kindly gentleman shut the hood. God forbid the engine should get wet. When I drove the car away, back to the Stanford campus, three neighbors called the police to report a possible theft of an abandoned car. That is my operational definition of community. People caring enough to take action in the face of an unusual or possibly illegal event on their turf. I believe such pro-social behavior comes from the assumption of reciprocal altruism. Others would do the same to protect their property or person. The message of this little demonstration is that conditions that make us feel anonymous when we think that others do not know us or care to can foster antisocial, self-interested behaviors. My earlier research highlighted the power of masking one's identity to unleash aggressive acts against other people in situations that gave permission to violate the usual taboos against interpersonal violence. This abandoned car demonstration extended that notion to include ambient anonymity as a precursor to violations of the social contract. Curiously, this demonstration has become the only bit of empirical evidence used to support the broken windows theory of crime, which posits public disorder as a situational stimulus to crime, along with the presence of criminals. Any setting that cloaks people in anonymity reduces their sense of personal accountability and civic responsibility for their actions. We see this in many institutional settings, such as our schools and jobs, the military, and prisons. Broken windows advocates argue that alleviating physical disorder, removing abandoned cars from the streets, wiping out graffiti, and fixing broken windows can reduce crime and disarray in city streets. There is evidence that such proactive measures work well in some cities, such as New York, but not as well in other cities. Community spirit thrives in a quiet, orderly way in places such as Palo Alto, where people care about the physical and social quality of their lives and have the resources to work at improving both. Here there is a sense of fairness and trust that contrasts with the nagging tugs of inequity and cynicism that drag down folks in some other places. Here, for example, people have faith in their police department to control crime and contain evil. Justifiably so, because the police are well-educated, well-trained, friendly, and honest. The police go by the book, which makes them act fairly, even if on rare occasions people forget that police are just blue-collar workers who happen to wear blue uniforms and can get laid off when the city budget is in the red. At rare times, however, even the best of them can let authority rule over their humanity. That doesn't happen often in a place like Palo Alto, but it did in a curious way that forms the backstory of how the Stanford prison experiment started off with a big bang. Town-gown confrontations at Stanford and beyond. The only blemish on the otherwise excellent service and citizenship record of Palo Alto's finest was their loss of composure during a confrontation with Stanford student radicals during the 1970s strike against the United States' involvement in Indochina. When these students started trashing campus buildings, I helped organize several thousand other students in constructive anti-war activities to show that violence and vandalism got only negative media attention and had no impact on the conduct of the war, while our pro-peace tactics might. Unfortunately, the new university president, Kenneth Pitzer, panicked and called in the cops, and as in many such confrontations happening all over America, too many cops lost their professional composure and beat up the kids they had previously felt it was their duty to protect. There were even more violent police-campus confrontations at the University of Wisconsin, October 1967, Kent State University in Ohio, May 1970, and Jackson State University in Mississippi, also May 1970. College students were shot at, wounded, and killed by local police and National Guardsmen, who in other times are counted on as their protectors. From the New York Times, May 2, 1970, pages 1 and 9. The resurgence of campus anti-war sentiment, with Cambodian developments as its central issue, took a variety of forms yesterday and included the following incidents. Two National Guard units were put on alert by Governor Marvin Mandel of Maryland after students at the University of Maryland clashed with the state police following a rally and a hit-and-run attack on the ROTC headquarters on the College Park campus. About 2,300 Princeton University students and faculty members voted to strike until at least Monday afternoon when a mass meeting is scheduled. This will conclude a boycott of all social functions. A student strike at Stanford University developed into a rock-throwing melee on the California campus. Police used tear gas to disperse the demonstrators. A Stanford report described a level of violence that had never before been seen on this bucolic campus. Police were called to campus at least 13 times and made more than 40 arrests. The most serious demonstrations occurred on April 29th and 30th, 1970, following news of the U.S. invasion in Cambodia. Police from as far away as San Francisco were summoned. Rocks were thrown, and tear gas was first used on campus during these two nights, which President Pitzer described as tragic. Approximately 65 people, including many police officers, were hurt. Hard feelings arose between the Stanford College community on the one side and the Palo Alto police and hardline Hawk townies on the other. This was a strange conflict because there had never been the same kind of love-hate, town-gown relationship that existed between the townies in New Haven and Yale University students that I had experienced as a graduate student. The new chief of police, Captain James Zurcher, who had taken charge of the department in February 1971, was eager to dissolve any lingering animosity from the riot-torn days of his predecessor, and was thus receptive to my request to collaborate in a program of city police Stanford student depolarization. Young, articulate officers conducted student tours of the police department's sparkling new facility, while students reciprocated by inviting police to share dormitory meals with them and sit in on classes. I suggested further that interested police rookies might even participate in some of our research. It was another sign that reasonable people could work out reasonable solutions to what seemed like insoluble social problems. However, it was in this context that I naively helped to create a new pocket of evil in Palo Alto. Chief Zurcher agreed that it would be interesting to study how men become socialized into the role of police officers and what would end up transforming a rookie into a good cop. "Great idea," I replied, "but that would require a big grant that I didn't have." But I did have a small grant to study what went into the making of a prison guard, since that was a role narrower in function as well as in territory. How about creating a prison in which rookie cops and college students would be both mock guards and mock prisoners? That sounded like a good idea to the chief. In addition to whatever I might learn, the chief felt that it would be a good personal training experience for some of his men. So he agreed to assign several of his rookies to be in this mock prison experience. I was delighted, knowing that with that foot in the door, I could then ask to have his officers conduct mock arrests of the students who were soon to become our prisoners. Shortly before we were ready to begin, the chief reneged on his promise to use his own men as mock prisoners or guards, saying they could not be spared for the next 2 weeks. Nevertheless, the spirit of détente was maintained, and he volunteered to assist in my prison study in whatever other way feasible. I suggested that the ideal way to start the study most realistically and with dramatic flair would be for his officers to stage arrests of the would-be mock prisoners. It would take only a few hours on an off-time Sunday morning, and it would surely make a big difference in the success of the research if the prisoners-to-be had their freedom suddenly stripped away, as they would in real arrests, rather than coming to Stanford voluntarily to surrender their freedom as research subjects. The chief acquiesced half-heartedly and promised that the duty sergeant would assign one squad car for this purpose on Sunday morning. Disaster. Mission about to abort before takeoff. My mistake was not getting this confirmation in writing. Reality checks demand written documents when an agreement is not filmed or taped. When I realized this truth on Saturday and called the station for a confirmation, Chief Zurcher was already away for the weekend. Bad omen. As I expected, on Sunday the duty sergeant had no intention of committing the Palo Alto Police Department to a surprise mass arrest of a band of college students for alleged penal code violations, certainly not without written authorization from his chief. No way this old-timer was going to get involved in any experiment conducted by someone like me, whom his vice president, Spiro Agnew, had dismissed as an effete intellectual snob. There were obviously more important things for his officers to do than to play cops and robbers as part of some lame-brained experiment. In his view, psychology experiments meant meddling into other people's affairs and finding out things better left private. He must have thought psychologists could read people's minds if they looked into their eyes, so he avoided looking at me when he said, "Sorry about that, Professor. I'd like to help you out, but rules are rules. Can't reassign the man to a new duty post without formal authorization." Before he could say, "Come back on Monday when the chief's here," I had a flash of this well-planned study going aground before even being launched. All systems were go. Our mock prison had been carefully constructed in the basement of Stanford's psychology department. The guards had selected their uniforms and were eagerly waiting to receive their first prisoners. The first day's food had already been bought. The prisoners' uniforms had been all hand-sewn by my secretary's daughter. Videotaping facilities and taped bugging of the prisoner cells had been readied. The university health department, the legal department, the fire department, and the campus police had all been alerted, and arrangements for renting beds and linens were complete. Much more had been done to accommodate the daunting logistics of dealing with at least 24 volunteers for 2 weeks, half living in our prison day and night, the others working 8-hour shifts. I had never before conducted an experiment that lasted more than 1 hour per subject per session. All this, and with one simple no, it might all crash and burn. Having learned that precaution is the better part of scientific wisdom, and that an ace in the hole is the best attribute of a Bronx wise guy, I had anticipated the scenario as soon as I learned that Captain Zurcher had split from the scene. Therefore, I had persuaded a San Francisco TV director at station KRON to film the exciting surprise police arrests as a special feature for its evening news program. I counted on the power of the media to soften institutional resistance, and even more on the lure of showbiz to get the arresting officers on my side, in front of the camera. "Sure is a shame, Sergeant, that we can't proceed today as the chief expected we would. We have a TV cameraman right here from Channel 4 all ready to film the arrests for tonight's evening news. It would have been good public relations for the department, but maybe the chief won't be too upset that you decided not to permit us to go ahead as planned." "Look, I didn't say I was against it. It's only that I'm not sure any of our men would be willing to do it. We can't just pull them off their duty, you know." Vanity, thy name is TV news time. "Why don't we leave it up to the two officers here? If they don't mind being filmed for TV while they go through a few routine police arrests, then maybe we could go ahead as the chief agreed we should." "No big thing, Sarge," said the younger officer, Joe Spiracco, combing his wavy black hair as he looked at the cameraman with his big camera resting snugly on his shoulder. "It's a slow Sunday morning, and this seems like it might be sort of interesting."
"All right, the chief must know what he's doing. I don't want to make any trouble if everything's all set up already. But hear me, you better be ready to answer any calls and cut the experiment short if I need you."
I chimed in, "Officers, would you spell your names for the TV man so that he can pronounce them right when the news report is shown tonight?" I needed to ensure their cooperation no matter what came up in Palo Alto before all of our prisoners had been arrested and gone through the formal booking process down here at headquarters.
Must be a pretty important experiment to have TV coverage and all, huh, Professor?
Officer Bob asked, straightening his tie and automatically fingering the handle of his gun.
I guess the TV people think so, I said, with full awareness of the precariousness of my perch.
What with surprise arrests by the police and all, it is a rather unusual experiment that might have some interesting effects. Probably that's the reason the chief gave us the go-ahead. Here is a list of the names and addresses of each of the 9 suspects to be arrested. I will be driving with Craig Haney, my graduate research assistant, behind your squad car. Drive slowly so the cameraman can film your movements. Arrest one at a time using your standard operating procedure. Read them their Miranda rights, search them, and handcuff them, as you would any dangerous suspect. The charge is burglary for the first 5 suspects, a 459 Penal Code violation, and make it armed robbery for the next 4 arrests, a Section 211 code. Return each one to headquarters for booking, fingerprinting, filling out criminal identification cards, and whatever you usually do. Then put each one in a detention cell while you pick up the next suspect on the list. We will transfer the prisoner from your holding cell to our jail. The only irregular thing we'd like you to do is to blindfold the prisoner when you put him into the holding cell, with one of these blindfolds. When we transfer him out, we don't want him to see us or know exactly where he is headed. Craig, with my other assistant, Kurt Banks, and one of our guards, Vandy, will do the transport.
Sounds fine, Professor. Bob and I can handle it just fine. No problem.
Now comes the main storyline. We leave the sergeant's front office to go downstairs to check out the booking room. Joe and Bob, Craig, the cameraman, Bill, and I. Everything is spanking new. This unit was just constructed within the main Palo Alto City Office Center, a short distance but a far cry from the old jail, which had become run down, not from overuse, but just old age. I wanted the officers and the cameraman to stay involved in the proceedings from the first arrest to the last, to keep the arrests as standardized as possible. I had debriefed the TV man earlier about the purpose of the study, but done so in a cursory manner because my concern had been winning over the anticipated resistance of the duty sergeant. It occurred to me that I should lay out for all of them some of the procedural details of the study, as well as some of the reasons for doing this kind of experiment. It would help create a team feeling and also show that I cared enough to take the time to answer their questions.
Do these kids know they're going to be arrested? Do we tell them it's part of an experiment or what?
Joe, they have all volunteered for a study of prison life. They answered an ad we put in the newspapers calling for college students who want to earn $15 a day to participate in a 2-week experiment on the psychology of imprisonment and...
You mean to say these kids are getting paid $15 a day to do nothing but sit in a jail cell for 2 weeks?
Maybe Joe and I could volunteer. Sounds like easy money.
Maybe. Maybe it's easy money. And maybe if anything interesting turns up, we will do the study again, using some police officers as prisoners and guards, as I had told your chief.
Well, you can count on us if you do. As I was saying, the 9 students you are about to arrest were part of a large group of about 100 men who answered our ads in the Palo Alto Times and the Stanford Daily. We screened out the obvious weirdos, the ones with prior arrests of any kind, and any with medical or mental problems. After an hour-long psychological assessment and in-depth interviews by my assistants, Craig Haney and Kurt Banks, we selected 24 of these volunteers to be our research subjects.
24 times $15 times 14 days is a lot of money you're going to have to pay out. It's not out of your pocket, is it, Doc?
It comes to $5,040, but the research is supported by a government grant from the Office of Naval Research to study antisocial behavior, so I don't have to pay the salaries myself.
Did all the students want to be prison guards?
Well, no. In fact, no one wanted to be a guard. They all preferred to take the prisoner's role.
How come? Seems like being a guard would be more fun and less hassle than being a prisoner. At least to me it does.
Another thing is that $15 for 24 hours work as a prisoner is peanuts. It's better pay for the guards if they only work usual shifts.
That's right.
The guards are planning to work 8-hour shifts, with 3 crews of 3 guards around the clock, covering the 9 prisoners. But the reason why these students preferred being in the prisoner role is that they might at some time become a prisoner, for draft evasion or DUI charges, for example, or arrested in some protest for civil rights or against the war. Most of them said they could never imagine ever being a prison guard. They didn't go to college in the hope of becoming a prison guard. So although they are all participating primarily for the money, some of them also expect to learn something about how they will handle themselves in this novel prison situation. How did you choose your guards? Bet you picked the biggest guys? No, Joe. We randomly assigned all the volunteers to each of the 2 conditions, like tossing a coin. If it came up heads, the volunteer was assigned to be a guard. If it was tails, a prisoner. The guards were told yesterday that they had come up heads. They came to our little jail in the basement of Stanford's psychology department to help us put the finishing touches on it, so that they would feel like it was their place. Each of them picked out a uniform at the local Army surplus store, and they're waiting now for the action to begin. Did they get any training to be guards? Wish I had time to do that, but all we did was give them a brief orientation yesterday. No specific training in how to act their new role. The main thing is for them to maintain law and order, no violence against prisoners, and not allow any escapes. I also try to convey to them the kind of psychological mindset of prisoners being powerless that we want to create in this prison. The kids you are going to arrest were simply told to wait at home, in a dormitory, or at some designated house if they lived too far away, and they would be hearing from us this morning. And so they soon will, huh, Joe? We'll give them the real thing. I'm a little confused about a couple of things. Sure, fire away, Joe. You too, Bill, if there's something you want to know to help share later with your producer for tonight's show. My question is this, Doc. What's the point of going through all the trouble to set up a prison of your own down at Stanford, arresting these college students, paying out all that money, when we already have prisons enough and criminals enough? Why not just observe what goes on in the county jail or the action over at San Quentin? Wouldn't that tell you what you want to know about guards and prisoners in real prisons? Joe had hit the nail right on the head. Instantly, I was into my college professor role, eager to profess to curious listeners. I'm interested in discovering what it means psychologically to be a prisoner or a prison guard. What changes does a person undergo in the process of adapting to that new role? Is it possible in the short time of only a few weeks to take on a new identity that is different from one's usual self? There have been studies of actual prison life by sociologists and criminologists, but they suffer from some serious drawbacks. Those researchers are never free to observe all phases of prison life. Their observations are usually limited in scope, without much direct access to prisoners, and even less to the guards. Since there are only 2 classes of people that populate prisons, staff and inmates, all researchers are outsiders viewed with suspicion, if not distrust, by all the system's insiders. They can see only what they are allowed to see on guided tours that rarely get beneath the surface of prison life. We'd like to better understand the deeper structure of the prisoner-guard relationship by recreating the psychological environment of a prison, and then to be in a position to observe, record, and document the entire process of becoming indoctrinated into the mental set of prisoner and guard. Yes, I guess it makes sense the way you put it, Bill chimes in. But the big difference between your Stanford jail and real ones is the type of prisoners and guards you're starting out with. In real prison, we're dealing with criminal types, violent guys who think nothing about breaking the law or attacking guards. And you gotta have tough guards to keep them in line, ready to break heads if necessary. Your sweet little Stanford kids aren't mean or violent or tough like real guards and prisoners are. Let me throw in a zinger, says Bob. How can you expect these college kids who know they're getting $15 a day for doing nothing will not just cool it for 2 weeks and have some fun and games at your expense, Doc? First, I should mention that our subjects are not all Stanford students. Only a few are. The others come from all over the country and even from Canada. As you know, a lot of young people come to the Bay Area in the summer and we recruited a cross-section of them who were just finishing summer school at Stanford or Berkeley. But you're right in saying that the Stanford County Jail will not be populated with the usual prison types. We went out of our way to select young men who seemed to be normal, healthy, and average on all the psychological dimensions we measured. Along with Craig here and another advanced graduate student, Kurt Banks, I carefully selected our final sample from among all those we interviewed. Craig, who had been waiting patiently for this sign of recognition from his mentor to get a word in edgewise, was ready to add to the thesis being laid down. In a real prison, when we observe some event, for example, prisoners stabbing each other or a guard smashing an inmate, we can't determine the extent to which the particular person or the particular situation is responsible. There are indeed some prisoners who are violent sociopaths, and there are some guards who are sadistic. But do their personalities account for all or even most of what goes on in prison? I doubt it. We have to take the situation into account. I beamed at Craig's eloquent argument. I also shared the same dispositional doubt, but felt reassured to have Craig put it so well to the police officers. I continued, warming into my best mini-lecture style. The rationale is this. Our research will attempt to differentiate between what people bring into a prison situation from what the situation brings out in the people who are there. By pre-selection, our subjects are generally representative of middle-class, educated youth. They are a homogeneous group of students who are quite similar to each other in many ways. By randomly assigning them to the two different roles, we begin with guards and prisoners who are comparable, indeed are interchangeable. The prisoners are not more violent, hostile, or rebellious than the guards, and the guards aren't more power-seeking authoritarians. At this moment, prisoner and guard are one and alike. No one wanted to be a guard. No one really committed any crime that would justify imprisonment and punishment. In 2 weeks, will these youngsters still be so indistinguishable? Will their roles change their personalities? Will we see any transformations of their character? That's what we plan to discover. Craig added, "Another way of looking at it is, you're putting good people in an evil situation to see who or what wins." "Thanks, Craig. I like that," gushed Cameraman Bill. "My director will want to use that tonight as a tease. The station didn't have a communicaster available this morning, so I have to both shoot and also come up with some angles to hook the arrest footage on. Say, Professor, time is running. I'm ready. Can we get started now?" "Of course, Bill. But, Joe, I never did answer your first question about the experiment." "Which was?" "Whether the prisoners knew they would be arrested as part of the experiment." "The answer is no. They were merely told to be available for participation in the experiment this morning. They may assume that the arrest is part of the research, since they know they did not commit the crimes for which they will be charged. If they ask you about the experiment, be vague. Neither say it is or isn't. Just go about doing your duty as if it were a real arrest. Ignore any of their questions or protests." Craig couldn't resist adding, "In a sense, the arrest, like everything else they will be experiencing, should merge reality and illusion, role-playing and identity." A bit flowery, I thought, but certainly worth saying. Just before Joe started the siren on his all-white squad car, he put on his silver reflecting sunglasses, the kind the guard wore in the movie Cool Hand Luke, the kind that prevents anyone from seeing your eyes. I grinned, as did Craig, knowing that all our guards would be donning the same anonymity-inducing goggles as part of our attempt to create a sense of de-individuation. Art, life, and research were beginning to merge. There's a cop knocking on the door.
"Mama, Mama, there's a policeman at the door and he's going to arrest Hubby," screeched the youngest Wicklow girl.
Mrs. Dexter Wicklow didn't quite hear the message, but from the sound of Nina's screech, there was some sort of trouble that Father should attend to.
"Please ask your father to see to it."
Mrs. Wicklow was involved in examining her conscience, because she had many misgivings about the changes that had been taking place in the church services from which she had just returned. She had also been thinking a lot about hubby recently, preparing herself for a life of twice-a-year visits from her beautiful, fuzzy-blonde, blue-eyed charmer. One blessing of his going away to college that she secretly prayed for was the out-of-sight, out-of-mind effect that would cool the all-too-obvious passion between hubby and his girlfriend from Palo Alto High School. For men, a good career had to come before hasty marriage plans, she told him often. The only fault she could find in this lovable child was that he sometimes got carried away when he was with his friends, like last month, when they had painted the tile rooftops on the high school for pranks, or when they went about reversing and ripping off street signs.
It's plain silly and immature, hubby, and you could get in trouble for it. Mama, Dad's not home. He's over at the golf course with Mr. Marston, and hubby's downstairs being arrested by a policeman.
Hubby Whitlow, you're wanted on a violation of Penal Code number 459, residential burglary. I'm going to take you to police headquarters for booking. And before I search and handcuff you, I must warn you of your rights as a citizen.
Mindful of the TV camera grinding away, recording for posterity this classic arrest, Joe was all super cop in stance and all Dragnet's cool Joe Friday in delivery.
Let me make some facts clear. You have the right to remain silent and are not required to answer any questions. Anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. You have the right to consult an attorney before you answer any questions, and an attorney may be present during the questioning. And if you have no funds to hire an attorney, the public defender will provide you with one to represent you at all stages of the proceedings. Do you understand your rights? Good. Having these rights in mind, I am taking you to Central Station for booking on the crime you are charged with. Now come peacefully over to the squad car.
Mrs. Whitlow was stunned to see her son being body-searched, handcuffed, and spread-eagled against the police car like a common criminal one sees on the TV news. Gathering her composure, she demanded courteously,
"What is this all about, officer?"
"Ma'am, I have instructions to arrest Hubby Whitlow on charges of burglary. He..."
"I know, officer. I told him not to take those street signs, that he shouldn't be influenced by those Jennings boys."
"Mama, you don't understand. This is part of..."
"Officer, Hubby's a good boy. His father and I will be glad to pay for the costs of replacing anything that was taken. You see, it was just a prank. Nothing serious intended."
By now a small crowd of neighbors was gathering at a respectable distance, lured by the treat of a threat to someone's security or safety. Mrs. Whitlow made a special effort not to notice them, so as not to be distracted from the task at hand, ingratiating herself with the police officer so he would be nicer to her son.
"If only George were here, he'd know how to handle the situation," she thought. "This is what happens when golf comes before God on Sunday."
"Okay, let's move along. We've got a busy schedule. There's a lot more arrests to be made this morning," Joe said as he moved the suspect into the squad car.
"Mama, Dad knows all about it. Ask him. He signed the release. It's all right. Don't worry. It's just part of..."
The wailing siren of the squad car and its flashing lights brought out even more curious neighbors to console poor Mrs. Whitlow, whose son seemed like such a nice boy. Hubby felt uneasy for the first time, seeing his mother's distress and feeling guilty sitting there alone in the back seat of a cop car, handcuffed behind the cop's protective mesh screen.
"So this is how it feels to be a criminal," he was thinking,
when his pink cheeks suddenly flushed with embarrassment as neighbor Palmer pointed at him and exclaimed to his daughter,
"What is this world coming to? Now it's the Whitlow boy who's committed a crime."
At the station, the booking procedure was dispatched with customary efficiency, given the cooperativeness of the suspect. Officer Bob took charge of Hubby while Joe discussed with us how this first arrest had gone. I thought it had taken a little too long, considering that there were 8 more to go. However, the cameraman wanted it to move more slowly so he could get positioned better, since he had to shoot only a few good arrest sequences to convey the story. We agreed that the next arrest could be deliberate in its filmed sequences, but after that, good TV shots or not, The experiment would come first, and the arrests would have to be sped up. Whitlow alone had already taken 30 minutes. At that rate, it would take most of the day to complete the arrests. I was mindful that the police's cooperation was not independent of the power of the media, so I worried that once the filming was completed, they might be reluctant to follow through with all the remaining arrests on the list. Interesting as this part of the study was to observe, I knew that its success was not under my control. So many things could go wrong, most of which I had anticipated and tried to counteract, but there was always the unexpected event that could wipe out even the best laid plans. There are too many uncontrolled variables in the real world, or the field, as social scientists call it. That's the comfort of laboratory research. The experimenter is in charge. The action is all under exquisite control. The subject is on the researcher's turf. It's as the police interrogation manuals caution. Never interrogate suspects or witnesses in their homes. Bring them to the station where you can capitalize on the unfamiliarity, seize on the lack of social supports, and, in addition, you need not worry about unplanned interruptions. I tried gently to urge the policeman to move a bit faster, but Bill kept intruding with requests for one more shot, one more angle. Joe was blindfolding Hubby. Form C-11-6, Bureau of Criminal Identification and Investigation, had been completed with the required information and full set of fingerprints, with only the mugshot remaining. We would do that with our Polaroid camera at our jail to save time, shooting after all prisoners were in their new uniforms. Hubby had navigated through the booking process without comment or emotion after his first and only attempt at a joke had been rebuffed by Joe. "What are you, a wise guy or something?" Now he was sitting in a small detention cell at Central Station, blindfolded, alone, and helpless, wondering why he had ever gotten himself into this mess, and asking himself whether it was worth it. But he took solace in knowing that if things got too tough to handle, his father and his cousin, the public defender, could be counted on to arrive and get him out of the contract. Oink, oink, the pigs are here. The next arrest scenario played itself out in a small Palo Alto apartment.
"Doug, wake up, dammit. It's the police. 1 minute, please. He's coming. Get your pants on, will you?"
"What do you mean, the police? What do they want with us? Look, Susie, don't get uptight. Act cool. We haven't done anything they can prove. Let me do the talking to the pigs. I know my rights. The fascists can't push us around."
Sensing a troublemaker at hand, Officer Bob used his friendly persuasion approach.
"Are you Mr. Doug Carlson?"
"Yeah, what of it?"
"I'm sorry, but you are suspected of Penal Code Violation Number 459, burglary, and I'm taking you downtown to the station for booking. You have the right to remain silent. You have..."
"Cut it. I know my rights. I'm not a college graduate for nothing. Where's the warrant for my arrest?"
As Bob was thinking about how to handle this problem tactfully, Doug heard the nearby church bells tolling.
"It's Sunday."
He had forgotten it was Sunday. He said to himself,
"Prisoner, huh? So that's the game. I prefer it. Didn't go to college to become a pig, but I might get ripped off by the police someday, like I almost did at last year's anti-war riots at Cal. As I told the interviewer, Haney, I think it was, I don't want this for the money and not the experience, because the whole idea sounds ridiculous, and I don't think it'll work. But I'd like to see how I deal with being oppressed as a political prisoner." I have to laugh when I think of their silly question. "Estimate the likelihood of your remaining in the prison experiment for the full 2 weeks on a 0 to 100% scale." "For me, 100%, with no sweat. It's not a real prison, only a simulated prison. If I don't dig it, I quit. Just walk away." And I wonder how they reacted to my answer to, "What would you like to be doing 10 years from now?" "My ideal occupation, which I hope would entail an active part in the world's future, the revolution. Who am I? What is unique about me?" How's my straight-from-the-shoulder answer? "From a religious perspective, I'm an atheist. From a conventional perspective, I'm a fanatic. From a political perspective, I'm a socialist. From a mental health perspective, I'm healthy. From an existential social perspective, I'm split, dehumanized, and detached, and I don't cry much.
Doug was reflecting on the oppression of the poor and the need to seize power back from the capitalist military rulers of this country as he sat defiantly in the rear of the squad car on its swift journey to the station house.
It's good to be a prisoner, he thought. All the exciting revolutionary ideas have come out of the prison experience.
He felt a kinship with Soledad brother George Jackson, liked his letters, and knew that in the solidarity of all oppressed people lies the strength to win the revolution. Maybe this little experiment would be the first step in training his mind and body for the eventual struggle against the fascists ruling America. The booking officer ignored Doug's flippant comments as his height, weight, and fingerprints were efficiently recorded. He was all business. Joe easily rolled each finger to get a clear set of fingerprints, even when Doug tried to make his hand rigid. Doug was a bit surprised at how strong the pig was, or maybe he was just a little weak from hunger, since he hadn't had any breakfast yet. Out of somber proceedings evolved a slightly paranoid thought.
Hey, maybe those rat finks at Stanford really turned me into the cops. What a fool I was, giving them so much personal background that they might use against me. Hey, copper, Doug called out in his high-pitched voice. Tell me again, what am I charged with?
Burglary. On a first conviction, you could be paroled in a couple of years. I am prepared to be arrested, sir. The next scenario occurs at the designated pickup place for Tom Thompson, the porch of my secretary, Roseanne. Tom was built like a baby bull, 5 feet 8 inches tall, 170 pounds of solid muscle under his crew cut. If there were ever a no-nonsense person, it was this 18-year-old soldier boy. When we had asked him in our interview, "What would you like to be doing 10 years from now?" his reply was surprising. Where and what are unimportant. The kind of work would involve organization and efficiency, producing in unorganized and inefficient areas of our government. Marital plans? I plan to marry only after I am solid financially. Any therapy, drugs, tranquilizers, or criminal experience? I have never committed a criminal act. I still remember the experience when I was 5 or 6 of seeing my father take a piece of candy to eat in a store while shopping. I was ashamed of his act. In order to save on rent money, Tom Thompson had been sleeping in the back seat of his car, accommodations that were neither comfortable nor well-suited to studying. Recently, he had had to fight off a spider that bit me twice, once on the eye and once on the lip. Nevertheless, he had just completed a full summer school course load in order to advance his credit standing. He was also working 45 hours a week at assorted jobs and eating leftover food at the student food service to save up for next fall's tuition. As a result of his tenacity and frugality, Tom planned to graduate 6 months early. He was also bulking up by exercising seriously in his spare time, which apparently he had a lot of given his total absence of dates or close friends. To be a paid participant in the prison study was the ideal job for Tom, since his studies and summer jobs were now over, and he needed the money. 3 square meals a day, a real bed, and maybe a hot shower were like winning the lottery. However, more than anything else, or anyone else, he envisioned the next 2 weeks as a paid vacation. He had not been doing squats for long on the porch at 450 Kingsley Street, where he was waiting to start his stint in our experiment, before the squad car pulled up behind his 65 Chevy. At a distance was Haney's Fiat, with the undaunted cameraman filming what was to be the last outside arrest. After this, he'd get more interior footage in the station, then over at our mock prison. Bill was eager to get back over to KRON with some hot video for what is usually a tame Sunday evening news show. "I'm Tom Thompson, sir. I am prepared to be arrested without any resistance." Bob was leery of this one. He might be some kind of nut who wanted to prove something with his karate lessons. The handcuffs were slapped on right away, even before Miranda rights were read. And his search for concealed weapons was more thorough than it had been with the others, because he had a funny feeling about guys who showed this particular kind of non-resistance. It was too cocky, too self-assured for someone facing an arrest. Usually it meant a trap of some kind. The dude was packing a gun, a false arrest charge was in the making, or there was something else out of the ordinary. "I'm no psychologist," Joe told me later, "but there is something off the wall about that guy Thompson. He's like a military drill officer, a sergeant in the enemy." Fortunately, there were no crimes that Sunday in Palo Alto, or cats stranded up trees, to summon Bob and Joe away from finishing their ever more efficient arrest procedures. By early afternoon, all of our prisoners had been booked and taken down to our jail, to the eager, waiting arms of our guards in the making. These young men would be leaving this sunny Palo Alto paradise, going down a short concrete staircase into the transformed basement of the psychology department in Jordan Hall on Sarah Street. For some, it would become a descent into hell.